Hello, everybody. I am John Allen, and this is Last Week in the Church, the show where we harvest the fruits of the last week in journalism on the Vatican and the Global Catholic Church beat. Of course, we are coming off Holy Week, and so here's what we've got for you this time. We begin with Health Watch. Once again, over the holiest period on the Christian calendar, Pope Francis gives us a little bit of a health scare, and once again, he proves himself to be the unsinkable pontiff, bouncing back in seemingly good form. Nevertheless, it does seem we are on a gradual trajectory towards an increasingly limited pope. We will explain why that's going to have greater consequences under Pope Francis than under previous popes. Second, the sounds of silence. In his traditional Easter Day Urbi et Orbi address, that is, blessing to the city and the world, the pope delivers one of his most important foreign policy speeches of the year. We'll explain why it was what Francis didn't say that in some ways was the story of the day, more so than what he actually did. Third, we've got It's Wednesday, and therefore there has to be another Pope book. And I'm not kidding. This video is being released on Wednesday, and today is the official on-sale date for the latest in is what a torrent of titles regarding Pope Francis. This one, an interview book with a Spanish journalist about the relationship between Francis and his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI. We will explain what Francis said and why it matters. And then finally, when a white flag doesn't mean peace. Recently, Pope Francis's invocation of a white flag in Ukraine's war with Russia was intended to promote the cause of peace. We'll explain why it has had the ironic effect, actually, of kickstarting a political civil war here in Italy. All that and more is waiting for you on this episode of Last Week in the Church, so please don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
Special thanks to our sponsor, St. Bernard School of Theology and Ministry, for their support of Crux and this episode of Last Week in the Church. St. Bernard's is a Catholic graduate school seeking to reunite theology, prayer, and sanctity. You can learn more about auditing a summer course for free at their website, www.stbernards.edu/free audit. Once again, that's www.stbernards.edu/free audit.
All right, everybody. Happy Wednesday to you. Thanks for being with us. I hope you had a wonderful Easter weekend, and I hope you also enjoyed very much Easter Monday, or as we call it here in Italy, Pasquetta, the little Easter. In Italy, the tradition is that you spend Easter Sunday with your family, and you spend Easter Monday or Pasquetta with your friends. Whoever you spent the Easter holiday with, I hope you had a wonderful and blessed time. And now we are back in the thick of it, so let's dive in. We begin with health scare, health alert, health bulletin, health hoopla, whatever you want to call it. But once again, during the Triduum, that is those three most sacred days on the Christian calendar, Pope Francis gave us a little bit of a scare, and yet, once again, he bounced back in seemingly strong and robust form. Basically, on Holy Thursday, the Pope traveled to Rome's Rebibbia prison. It's the largest prison here in town. Coincidentally, it is also the end of the red line on the Roman metro, that is the Roman subway. And he visited the women's wing of the prison. So for the very first time, when he came to the foot-washing portion of the Holy Thursday liturgy, all of the feet he washed that evening belonged to women. And he seemed in very good form. He gave one of his sort of extemporaneous, you know, off-the-cuff homilies. And it was sort of, you know, Francis's greatest hits, including, you know, what has become one of his standard tropes, the idea that God never gets tired of forgiving. It is we who get tired of asking for forgiveness. And, you know, he seemed for all the world not only to be in good form, but genuinely to be enjoying himself. Then we come to Good Friday. It was anticipated that Pope Francis was going to preside over the traditional Via Crucis ceremony, that is the way of the cross, traditionally held in Rome at the Colosseum on the evening of Good Friday. And in fact, they had the white throne for the Pope sitting there TV cameras trained on it. However, at the last minute, it was announced the Pope had decided not to go in order to preserve his strength for what was coming in terms of Holy Saturday and then Easter Sunday. Also Pasquetta, for that matter, because he had to deliver an Angelus address on Easter Monday as well. And logically, this made all the sense in the world. I mean, frankly, it's a bit of a mystery to those of us who follow the Pope why they dangled the illusion that he was going to go to the Via Crucis in the first place. This is a Pope who has been struggling with bronchitis, struggling with respiratory difficulties. Even though the days here in Rome around Easter have been gorgeous, at night it still gets cold, and it's a very humid cold. So if you've got somebody who's struggling with bronchitis, it is exactly the worst atmosphere that you would want to have them sitting out in the open for several hours in. So why they even contemplated this is a bit difficult to fathom. But in any event, the fact that the Pope didn't go set off a bit of a frisson among those who are inclined to overinterpret everything. But nevertheless, you know, on Holy Saturday and on Easter Sunday, he once again seemed in very good form. On Easter Sunday, not only did he celebrate the morning mass, but he also was able to read in his own voice. And although it was a bit hoarse, a bit raspy, nevertheless, it was a strong and clear voice. He was able to read his entire Urbi et Orbi message, and he seemed fine on Easter Monday as well. However, what all this suggests is that we are in a situation now in which increasingly Pope Francis is going to be withdrawing from, or at least limiting, what we might call routine activity in order to preserve his strength, his capacity for what we might consider his peak moments. Now, you know, what those peak moments are going to be will, of course, be in the eye of the beholder, and in this case, the beholder is the Pope himself. So I think it is reasonable to expect that there are certain trips, for instance, that Pope Francis may really, really want to make, and he will try to conserve his strength to be able to do that. We know for sure that he wants to be able to preside over the Synod of Bishops on Synodality this October. It is, again, certainly he wants to open it. He will want to take part in the discussions as much as he can. He will want to be able to bring it to a close. It's reasonable to assume that he may choose to forego, dial down, curtail more routine activity in order to permit himself to be able to do those things. Now, in some ways, there's absolutely nothing new about this. We saw this towards the end of the John Paul II papacy. We saw this progressively as Benedict XVI's 8-year papacy went on. Going back earlier in time, we certainly saw it at the end of the Paul VI years. However, there is something of a difference. Because, and here's the difference. During the end of the John Paul reign, that is 2003, 2004, 2005, as John Paul was increasingly limited, that was certainly clear in terms of the Pope's public availability. It didn't really register much, however, in terms of routine governance. That is, you know, bishops continued to be appointed at the same clip they always had been. Teaching documents continued to come out. Decrees, legal decrees, continued to be issued. Events continued to be organized. And that is because John Paul was never very much interested in making the Vatican's trains run on time. He delegated all that to others. Routine internal governance was never the Pope's personal predilection. He was very much an odd extra pope, interested in engaging the wider world, not so much in the nuts and bolts of moving the levers of power in the Vatican. And that was true of Benedict XVI as well. Pope Francis, on the other hand, is very much a governing pope. He has the reins of power quite firmly in his own hands. He is not a delegator, at least when it comes to the most important decisions. And so as Pope Francis becomes increasingly limited, I think we can begin to expect to see the consequences of that, not just in terms of the public register of the papacy, but also the behind-the-scenes dimension of governance. In other words, we may see a slowdown in how quickly new bishops are named. We may see fewer legal decrees, motu proprio, and so on. We may see a slower pace of Vatican reform. We may see fewer documents being issued with teaching significance or disciplinary significance. Now, Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, of course, will depend on your point of view. If you think we've been on Mr. Toad's wild ride for the last 11 years and we could use a break, you may see this as a positive thing. Those who are hoping that Pope Francis will nail down as much of his legacy as possible in the time he has remaining may find this frustrating. But in any event, my point is, with a pope who has the reins of power firmly in his own hands, when he slows down, that means governance slows down with him. That's likely what we're going to see in increasing doses as we go forward. All right, second up this week, the sound of silence. So, on Easter Sunday, obviously the most important task any pope faces is to celebrate the Easter liturgy marking the resurrection of Christ, right? The victory of life over death. However, second up for any pope is to deliver the traditional Urbi et Orbi address, that is, to the city and to the world, which is typically a 360-degree review of the global situation. It is understood to be the second most important foreign policy speech any pope gives every year, coming after only his speech in January to the diplomatic corps accredited to the Holy See. And, you know, once again, Pope Francis delivered. He addressed all of the hotspots that you would likely expect him to. He began with the war between Ukraine and Russia, repeating his call for a ceasefire, adding a proposal for an immediate, comprehensive exchange of prisoners between Russia and Ukraine, as he put it, tutti per tutti, all for all. And in a line that is likely to irritate some Ukrainians, he said, the path to peace is not through rearmament. This, of course, comes at a moment when Ukrainians are desperately trying to convince the United States government to rearm them, trying to get the U.S. to pass a $60 million armament package for Ukraine that would allow them to continue to prosecute their war with Russia. But in any event, more or less what you would have expected the Pope to say. He then, of course, turned to the situation in Gaza, once again repeated his call for a ceasefire in Gaza and also the humanitarian access so that aid could reach the besieged civilian populations there. He then turned to other global hotspots. He talked about Lebanon and Syria. He touched upon African conflicts such as Sudan, the Sahel, the Democratic Republic of Congo, particularly the Eastern Kivu province, the Cabo Delgado province of Mozambique. He mentioned the Rohingya people in Myanmar. He talked about human trafficking and the effects of climate change, food security and hunger. I mean, in other words, sort of most of the preeminent social and geopolitical concerns that are associated with the Francis papacy. I think what is probably more interesting, I mean, and all of that quite predictable, nonetheless important for being predictable, but nevertheless, probably what you would have anticipated. I think what is perhaps more striking were the omissions from the Pope's review of the global situation. For instance, he mentioned the Rohingya people in Myanmar. He did not mention the Uyghur people in China, which is another ethnic and religious minority that is currently being brutalized by a regime that has proven itself hostile to this minority. The difference being that in the case of the Rohingya, that regime is in Myanmar. In the case of the Uyghurs, of course, that regime is in China. In his review of global hotspots, he did not mention the South China Sea and what's been going on there recently, with Taiwan conducting missile drills in response to what are known as gray zone incursions by China, that is a series of deliberately provocative maneuvers intended to limit Taiwan's freedom of action and remind the world of mainland China's claim of sovereignty over the island of Taiwan. No mention of that. Equally, there was no mention of ethnic and religious violence in India, despite the fact that religious minorities, including the Christian minority in India, which is reeling from violence in the state of Manipur, which has left hundreds of people dead, tens of thousands displaced, according to one report, as many as 300 Christian churches destroyed. And we have elections coming up next month in India that are expected to reinforce the stranglehold on power of Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Hindu nationalist BJP party. There is real concern among religious minorities in India about what they perceive to be a rapidly deteriorating climate for religious freedom. No mention of any of that. Why? Well, probably I think the reasons are both pastoral and political. To begin with the political, China and India are two of the Pope Francis's most important diplomatic and geopolitical interlocutors. Of course, he has a deal with China regarding the appointment of Catholic bishops in the country. He is increasingly tied to India on any number of issues, from the war in Ukraine and the situation in Gaza to climate change and points beyond. And so there is a political desire, quite honestly, not to upset the apple cart. I think the pastoral calculus is that anything the Pope might say could potentially make the situation worse in those two places, because these are two emerging global superpowers that might not exactly be thrilled to be publicly shamed by a pontiff and might decide to deploy some of their power to make life even more complicated and treacherous for Christians, i.e. the Pope's own flock in these two places. Something of the same calculus may be why the Pope didn't say anything about Nicaragua, despite the fact that the regime of President Daniel Ortega essentially banned Easter in Nicaragua. Well, that's a bit of an overstatement. But they banned any public celebration of Easter. That is, they banned any outdoor processions or celebrations, saying that religious rituals had to be conducted exclusively indoors. Second year in a row, they've done that. This part of an ongoing brutal assault on religious freedom, and particularly the maneuvering of the Catholic Church by the Ortega regime. Ortega's wife, Vice President Rosa Murillo, actually suggested that instead of religious processions around Easter, they should have processions celebrating the country's socialist identity. That is an overt attempt to sort of dethrone Catholicism as the sort of popular faith of Nicaragua. Silence from the Pope on this as well. And once again, you have to figure that part of the calculation here was pastoral. The Pope was concerned that if he were to say anything, if he were perceived to be publicly confrontational with the Ortega regime, it might make things worse. Now, you can make of this what you will. You could argue this was prudence on the part of Pope Francis, or you could argue it was moral cowardice. But whatever you want to make of it, there is no denying that when the Pope and his team put together something like the Urbi et Orbi address, they have to think about not only what the Pope is going to say, they also have to make tough, often agonizing decisions about what he is not going to say. And threading that needle, striking that balance correctly, I don't think it's anybody's idea of a good time. And once again, it's cause for me to get down on bended knee and thank a loving God that I don't have to make those judgment calls. All right, next up this week, it's Wednesday, so therefore there has to be a new Pope book. The Pope book in this question, which does in fact go on sale today, April 3rd, 2024, is titled The Successor. And it's an interview book with Pope Francis put together by Spanish journalist Javier Martinez Brocol, who is actually not only a colleague of my wife Elise and I, but also a friend of ours. Actually, he lives in our neighborhood. We sometimes see him at our little neighborhood parish of Mary, Queen of the Apostles. Good egg, fundamentally, and a good journal. And this book is focused on the relationship between Pope Francis and his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI. There are multiple points of interest, but let me just focus here on two. One has to do with the conclave of 2005. That was the conclave that elected Pope Benedict XVI. Pope Francis discusses what went on behind closed doors there in the Sistine Chapel in unusual detail. He begins by noting that while cardinals take an oath to maintain secrecy about what happens during a conclave, popes are under no such obligation. Popes, as he said, have license to say whatever they want. And so he proceeded to do precisely that. And essentially, the story as he tells it was that in the conclave of 2005, after the death of John Paul, there was a group of cardinals that wanted to block the election of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who would eventually become Pope Benedict. And their strategy for doing that was in the early stages to throw their support behind then Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio of Buenos Aires in Argentina, with the idea of preventing Ratzinger from getting a two-thirds majority. And then once it became clear that Ratzinger wasn't going to be elected, they were going to shift from Bergoglio to someone else. Now, Pope Francis did not say who he thought that someone else would have been. It was speculated, by the way, this is not the first time that this scenario has been floated. It had been speculated at the time that there was a plan to sort of bog Ratzinger down and then it produce potentially Italian Cardinal Camillo Ruini, who had been the Pope's Vicar of Rome under John Paul II and president of the powerful Italian Bishops' Conference. He was considered the great Italian hope in 2005. But in any event, as Pope Francis tells the story, he got wind of what was going on, and then he went to another cardinal, Colombian Cardinal Dario Castrolón Hoyos, who has since deceased, but was nevertheless perceived as one of the kingmakers in 2005. And obviously someone that Pope Francis perceived to be in on this plot to sort of block Ratzinger and produce somebody else. And basically he said that he told Castrolón to stop screwing around. Stop using me in this fashion, because if you keep doing it, I'm going to go in there and tell people I won't accept election. And that apparently broke the logjam. On the next ballot, Cardinal Ratzinger gets the two-thirds majority. He needs to be elected Pope and, of course, becomes Pope Benedict. Pope Francis said at that time that Cardinal Ratzinger was his candidate because he believed that after all the dynamism, all of the tumult, all of the activity of the John Paul years, it would have been a mistake, Pope Francis said, for me to be elected at that moment because I was going to make a mess. Said what we needed was some breathing space. We needed a transitional pope, a pope who could strike a healthy balance. Ratzinger was exactly the right guy, and so Pope Francis said Benedict had his support. So that is, according to Pope Francis, in any event, that is the story of how Pope Benedict got elected. Now, some people on social media have tried to pick this apart, noting under the rules as John Paul had set them up, you didn't technically need a two-thirds majority to get elected, because had a conclave gone on long enough, it would have taken roughly 30 ballots. So it would have taken almost 2 weeks. But had it gone on that long, you could have gotten to a situation where a simple majority would have sufficed. However, the practical reality is the cardinals were never going to let it go that long because they didn't want the impression of, you know, a divided conclave and sort of smoke-filled backroom deals. They wanted to wrap this up quickly. So, in other words, I don't think there's any prima facie reason to suspect that there is some problem with the reconstruction that Pope Francis gives in this book. Now, the other interesting element of this book is how he describes the relationship between himself and Benedict after Pope Francis's election in 2013. First, a footnote. Pope Francis says that in 2005, he's the one who cleared the path for Ratzinger to be elected as Pope Benedict. According to Francis, in 2011, Pope Benedict returned the favor because he says in 2011, there were officials in the then Congregation for Bishops who wanted to force through Cardinal Bergoglio's resignation in Buenos Aires. And it was Pope Benedict, according to Francis, who stepped in and said, nah, we're going to leave him where he is. And of course, that meant he was still the Cardinal of Buenos Aires in 2013 and got elected Pope for his trouble. Basically, what Francis says about the relationship between him and Benedict is that personally, they had a marvelous relationship. He said Benedict defended him at every turn. He says, for instance, early on in his papacy, you may remember, there was a sort of brouhaha when it emerged that Pope Francis was in favor of civil unions for same-sex couples, that is not sacramental marriage, but the possibility under civil law for them to regularize their relationship. This caused a good deal of consternation and controversy, but he says Pope Benedict actually took some cardinals aside and explained the difference between civil unions and sacramental marriage, saying this is not heresy. In other words, Francis is saying Benedict had his back. And he said this was a repeated pattern in terms of their relationship. On the other hand, it is also clear that Pope Francis believed that not all of Benedict's guys always had his back. He takes a small stab at Cardinal Robert Sada of Guinea, who was involved in 2020 in the publication of a book defending priestly celibacy that was perceived as a criticism of Pope Francis, to which Pope Benedict contributed in an essay. Francis says of Sada, he's a good man, holy man, but he was manipulated by some separatists and said maybe working in the Roman Curia made him a little bitter. Of course, as a standard Pope Francis maneuver, if you've got a problem, you blame it on the blue meanies in the Roman Curia, right? And then the real target, however, wasn't Sada. The real target was German Archbishop Georg Gainswein, Pope Benedict's longtime private secretary. Pope Francis says at one point that Gainswein did some very unpleasant things to me. He specifically mentions one time when he had removed someone from a position in the Vatican, and then Gainswein engineered a photo op with Pope Benedict immediately afterwards, making it look like Pope Benedict was undercutting Francis's decision. And this was offered as an example of what Pope Francis described as a pattern of Gainswein, often sort of putting Benedict in positions where he was appearing to be breaking with or indirectly criticizing Pope Francis. So to sum up, Pope Francis is full of praise for Benedict himself, for Benedict's posse, I think it's fair to say, not so much. Finally this week, and very briefly, Pope Francis recently invoked the image of a white flag, suggesting it might be time for Ukraine to sort of admit that it's not going to win an outright military victory in its conflict with Russia and instead seek a negotiated settlement, saying it's time to embrace the courage of the white flag. This, obviously, part of the Pope's ongoing campaign to promote peace. However, ironically, that effort to promote peace has had the unintended effect here in Italy of sort of opening a political civil war, because one of the most outspoken supporters of the Pope's position on the pacifist position, if you like, on the Ukraine conflict is a former editor of L'Avvenire, that's the newspaper of the Italian Bishops' Conference, a veteran Italian journalist by the name of Marco Tarquinio, who is now being considered as a potential candidate for Italy's left-leaning Democratic Party in the European elections this June. Now, this is in part an effort by the Democrats, who officially are pro-Ukraine, anti-Russia, support, you know, Ukraine's legitimate right to self-defense and so on, but nevertheless have seen some of their support bleed away to the populist left-leaning Five Star Movement that has a very strong pacifist position, that is strongly opposed to arming Ukraine, strongly opposed to the continuation of this war. And so this is in part a maneuver by the Democrats to try to siphon some of that support by fielding a candidate who appeals to that constituency. The problem, however, is that Tarquinio isn't simply a pacifist on Ukraine. He's actually also robustly pro-life. That is, he is anti-abortion. He is anti-gay marriage. He is anti-euthanasia. He is anti a controversial homophobia law here in Italy. That is, he represents a kind of robustly orthodox pro-life Catholic line. The question is whether a party that has self-consciously named itself after the Democratic Party in the United States, and which is in some ways emulating left-of-center parties across the Western world, is going to be able to make room for such a pro-life Catholic point of view, even in overwhelmingly Catholic Italy. We will see. Stay tuned. That's our show for this week. You can find full coverage of all these stories on the Crux site, that is www.cruxnow.com. I hope you had a fantastic and blessed week. We will be back here next week, same bat time, same bat channel. I will talk to you again very, very soon.